And
so, what is going on with that microphone? Yeah, I can't turn my mic anymore. I'm all discombobulated, man. There. Anyway, yeah.
All good now.
Yeah, what have you been doing? Have you been on the internet this week?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. It's depressing.
I've been on the internet just saying, what most people do on the internet, I suppose, just saying outrageous things that I don't believe. In order to get people to respond to me, to get attention.
Yeah, I did a bit of that this week.
Most people seem to occupy themselves on the internet doing that. Well, maybe not most, but yeah, I'd say a good 50% or more is they take up their time saying outrageous things that they don't believe, just in order to get some attention, and then laugh at people whenever they give them attention for it.
And then the other 50% react
and
get into arguments.
Yeah. Getting into arguments with people who have said things that they don't believe.
Yeah. That they're not serious about.
Yeah, they're not serious. And you only find out afterwards.
The kids see you're farming for the keks.
Farming the keks. Farming the lols.
Lols, keks, laughs.
Yeah.
Just to get a reaction out of you.
You're just farming them. You're sowing the lols of the keks, and then you wait a while and then you reap them in the harvest.
Yeah. And the more people you can get engaged in a firefight, the better.
That's the internet for you, yeah. Anyway, yeah, you take it all with a grain of salt, really. Don't forget, people are stupid. It's a general rule.
It's, you know, the way, like, if the one thing that a lot of both ancient and modern health-focused, well-being-focused research and emphasis is placed on is meditation, right? Mm. It's to quiet down everything that's going on inside you.
Your chattering mind.
Yeah, just meditate in various ways. The internet, in its current configuration, is the opposite. It's like,
is the anti-meditation.
Fire it up in as many directions as you can. You know?
Yeah.
The one thing we need is like the furthest away from what we get. But then again, it is like, it's a challenge, but
well, just
you can use it well, you know?
Well, it can be teaching moments. Use it as teaching moments. Not that anybody's up for being taught, like, you know what I mean? I don't think there's many people on the internet are interested in a lesson anyway. Not that, you know, we would assume that we could give anybody a lesson for the reason that a lot of people aren't interested in it, and also who's to say that you're able to. But this jumped out at me for some reason. I get this. I'm on Blaze Media, Glenn Beck show. Glenn Beck, he has a radio show. He's like, what is he? Is he conservative or something? Sort of conservative, weird LARPer.
Yeah, he is.
Conservative LARPer.
No, I think he's sincere enough. Yeah.
Did he not used to be a lefty?
He's uber Israel, though.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not just a minor problem, it's really problematic.
Yeah.
It kind of marks you out as, it's so normal in the US to be conservative and pro-Israel, but it's, in the rest of the world, it's definitely a fringe stance to be socially conservative but uber Israel. The rest of the world sees that as weird.
Not except for the UK.
Okay, they have a lot of American influence there, but
not the Anglo-Americans.
Outside of the Twin Towers.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a hold of the Israeli lobby on the American mind, basically, on American politics and everything. Anyway, this guy, he's Uber, and he says, this was the headline, what the IDF just said about Hamas should terrify everybody. This is according to Glenn Beck. So he's immediately saying you should be terrified, so you should read his article, because people want to be terrified, right? Or people want to know what they should be terrified about, I suppose, right? If there's something out there I should be terrified about, I want to know it, right?
Click.
Anyway,
I should be terrified.
But it's kind of interesting. The thing I wanted to say about it was that supposedly the thing you should be terrified about is what this Israeli IDF admiral said. And the admiral said, whomever thinks it's possible to destroy Hamas is wrong. Hamas is an idea. Whomever thinks it's possible to make it disappear is wrong. So you can't, it's this, the IDF general was saying, like, Hamas is an idea, an ideology, it's a resistance movement, and it's you can't just kill people and think it'll kill the idea. And Glenn respectfully disagrees, because he says that, no, you're wrong. He says Hamas isn't just an idea. If you go further down, ideas grow and grow until they become almost an entity. And then he raises up the Nazis, right? So everybody I don't like is a Nazi, right? So I don't like Hamas, or they're Nazis. So Nazis' ideas are not dead, and maybe they never will be, but Nazi Germany is dead, says Glenn Beck. And then he makes gives another example of saying, should we end all policing like they're starting to here in America, because someone's always going to steal and murder? Like, stealing and murder is an idea, therefore... you can never get rid of stealing and murder, therefore you shouldn't try and stop stealing and murder. Of course you should try and stop stealing and murder.
That's just silly.
And Hamas and the Nazis, which already, you know, is off on the wrong foot there. Hamas and the Nazis, and therefore, okay, you'll never get rid of Nazi ideology, Nazi/Hamas ideology, but you can't get rid of Hamas like we got rid of the Nazis, right? And sure, it'll still be there in the background. Now, the problem here is that he has the Israel first attitude here, and the IDF guy is actually correct in saying that anybody who believes it's possible to destroy Hamas is wrong, because Hamas is an idea and you can't destroy that idea. The thing is, you can destroy certain ideas that are bad ideas. Generally, from a humanistic point of view, are seen as being are objectively bad ideas, like the Nazis. Let's enslave and kill everybody, or kill large numbers of people and that kind of stuff, because we're better than everybody else. That's a bad idea, and that's never going to really sustain itself in human society for any length of time. It is going to be, sure, it's lurking around there in the background all the time, but it's never going to really persist for very long. Because,
like Zionism.
Exactly. So that's the thing. So he would subscribe, Glenn Beck claims that Hamas is basically, it's a bad idea. It's like a Nazi idea. It's like kill everybody, kill all the Jews idea. But it's not. It's the IDF general actually knows more than Glenn Beck, obviously, because he knows, although he wouldn't say this openly, the IDF general, but what he's pointing to when he says, or he's tacitly admitting to when he says that you can't kill the idea of Hamas, is because it's a good idea. Good ideas never go away. You can't kill a good idea. Like in V for Vendetta, right?
Right.
V for Vendetta, he said that actually to, I think... what was his name?
To Creedy
asked him.
Behind this mask is more than a man.
Right.
And ideas are bulletproof.
Ideas are bulletproof, exactly. And he didn't say what. That's a bit general, but the more specifically, good ideas, positive, positively humanistic, humanistically positive ideas are bulletproof.
The IDF general
always
was tacitly recognizing that Hamas is a resistance movement with popular support.
Not only that, it's popular
therefore,
support, that's
the only way for it to succeed in the way Beck says is you've got to kill all those people.
Right, but you can't. But even the IDF general is saying that doesn't matter. Yeah. You won't, even if you kill all those people, you won't kill the idea, because that idea is within human beings and has been from time immemorial. It's part of human DNA that when people are being oppressed by a aggressive, violent, xenophobic, racist, murderous, genocidal regime like Israel, that no matter where that kind of regime, that attitude, or that belief system, I suppose, raises its head, it will always be resisted, it will always be pushed back against by the mass of ordinary human beings.
Yeah.
So,
Glenn Beck.
But it's an example, like, that's why the Nazi ideology went away and didn't really take sway, didn't really hold sway for a long period of time, doesn't really, you know, isn't still extant in amongst, you know, large numbers of people around the world. There aren't a large number of people around the world all harbouring or openly supporting the essence of Nazi ideology. But people all around the world always do and do hold in their minds the essence of what you could call Hamas's ideology, which is, it's not Hamas's ideology, it's an ideology, and it's the ideology of resistance against oppression, brutality, aggression, genocide. And that will always exist. So the IDF in general is correct, and Glenn Beck is wrong. And not that it matters to Glenn Beck, but And by saying that, the IDF general is admitting that he is on the wrong side.
Yeah, Beck is a boomer. He's a boomer. He doesn't understand what's happened. I wrote this week that the Overton window has shifted. Mm. I mean, it's too late. Israel's screwed. Like, Israel / wider Jewry is in serious trouble. It may, maybe not in the United States, maybe not in Western Europe, but everywhere else is like, they've really royally screwed up everything. I mean, what the South African president says here, South Africa, people remember, applied successfully to have the case for genocide heard in the international court. This is the only official term who will say that. But behind this statement is, you know, basically easily the majority of world opinion. Stopping Gaza conflict, he says, is a test for humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Not the president, sorry, the foreign minister. That's what they're doing by attacking Hamas is trying to bring it back to Israel's framing of it. But it, like I said, the Overton window shifted, and Israel's framing only holds now in the United States, mostly, maybe Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Just focus on it. Hamas equals terrorists, therefore war on terror, but we're way past that. I mean, when Piers Morgan is starting to wobble, you know, in on British TV talk shows, and he's like, this has gone a bit far. You know, it's changed. It's Beck is talking to the choir of kind of boomer rhino Americans. Now, he's come out. He used to be never Trumper, but he changed position.
Yeah, right.
Because Trump was so damn popular. He did change, but boomer. That world is gone. I'm not saying that, you know, everything is, we're still in the consequences of that previous, of the old world, but if you're talking about ideologies that won't survive this, Zionism won't.
Mm.
It may take another 20 years, but it's the fact that that has been said in at least some official quarters, and the fact that that statement is backed up by a court, a hearing at the ICJ, okay, it didn't utterly condemn Israel, but it's enough to have it, you know, in the news at all. I mean,
yeah. Did you see this, again, talking about Israel? Talking about Israel being on the way out type thing in terms of its its ideology. This has happened, of course, many, many times before, and it's kind of strange, like over the past 20 years. This is standard operating procedure for the IDF Israeli soldiers in the West Bank particularly, because that's where they've been operating, you know, since 2005 primarily. I mean, on the ground with, you know, troops on the ground and stuff before October 7th, obviously. But this happens all the time, and it's basically the Israeli army strapping a wounded Palestinian to a jeep. So they had
as a literal human shield.
Literally a human shield. And of course they would say that's
what Hamas
meme
does.
That they've repeatedly accused Hamas of doing, using. So when Israel, you know, drops a 500-pound bomb or a 1-ton bomb on an apartment building in Gaza full of people, all the civilians who die, which is pretty much all of them, they were all human shields used by Hamas. Like, we wanted to target that building because we have intelligence that says it was used by Hamas, which is the Palestinian people, basically. And therefore, we had to target it because it's a legitimate military target. And the fact that there were lots of families living there is evidence of Hamas using them as shields, you know. So that's Israel's narrative, which is obviously laughable. But then you have stuff like this, you know, where I'm actually... And again, like I said, this is not the first time. It's weird that this comes out now, you know, because it's like... That's not new. That's not news. Anybody who is paying attention to the situation in Palestine over the past 20, 30, 40 years knows that that happens all the time. But there you go. It's still happening. And that's what Israel does and what it's always done. And they said that basically... So the IDF confirmed the incident after it was captured on video, i.e. they only were forced to confirm it after it was captured on video and shared on social media. And they said the man was wounded in an exchange of fire during the raid. Yeah, that's, yeah, there's no evidence to suggest that that guy was anything other than someone who was injured, unprovoked by the Israelis, by the IDF shooting at people randomly, as they do. And then in order to prevent, they hope, an attack on that jeep, they tie one of the injured civilians to the front of it.
Have you ever seen that in any other conflict situation? Northern Ireland? Iraq?
No.
Afghanistan?
No.
The only other reference I have for that is from pop culture, from a TV show, in Firefly, when the Reavers strap their victims to the front of their, after they've, you know, ripped the skin off, to the front of the spaceship.
Mm.
Like, I have to go to sci-fi for anything comparable to that reality. I mean, why Glenn Beck, you know, can say, I'm Jewish, I'm more Jewish than the Jews. He's not really Jewish, but whatever, he's ideologically Jewish. And think he's, you know, playing third base for them, but, like, it's a losing battle. That's why they want to ban TikTok, because they've lost American youth. They're watching this stuff on TikTok. It's over.
Yeah, it almost, I mean, the very fact that the Israelis have done that, like I said, for a long time, is again almost a tacit admission of the kind of relative decency and humanity of a Palestinian resistance. That they only do
they
that.
They wouldn't do that in kind.
They only do that because they know that it's effective. They wouldn't keep doing it if it wasn't effective. Like I said, they've been doing it for 20, 30, 40 years in Palestine, and they only do it because they know it's effective, and it's effective because it means that that Palestinian resistance or Hamas or whoever will not attack that Israeli jeep because it's got a Palestinian tied to the front of it, that they won't kill him, whereas it probably has happened.
They're not just doing it because they're sick. It has effect. It's functionally useful.
Yeah, they are doing it because they're sick in a certain sense. But it exposes the fact that, exposes the lie of their narrative about Hamas, about them being bloodthirsty, murderous terrorists who use their own people to
ideological aims.
Well, they use their own people as human shields. They force us. I think Netanyahu has said in the past that they force us to kill Palestinians. You know, they make it impossible for us. Well, they deliberately put Palestinians in place that they know we're going to target, so that there will be a lot of civilian casualties, because they know that that's a propaganda victory for them, and they really, you know, Hamas really torture and abuse us poor Israelis by forcing us to kill their civilians. We don't want to kill their civilians, but they force us to kill their civilians because we obviously have a right to defend ourselves, and we have to target these military installations or Hamas headquarter places to protect our people. But they make it very difficult for us, and they hold us up to public shaming for something we're doing, which is actually something positive and good and right, to fight these terrorists. But they smear us by deliberately putting Palestinian civilians in the places that are legitimate military targets, in order to, not as an attempt to try and stop us from targeting those areas, but because they know we'll do it anyway. And that they know those civilians will be killed, and then they'll say, look, Israel killed Palestinians. So it's really Hamas who's killing those Palestinians.
Yeah.
When we drop a bomb on an apartment block, it's Hamas who's killing those people, right? Because Hamas doesn't care anything about Palestinian people, right? They use them just as tools. They're nothing more than just, you know, they're waste in a certain sense. They're just useful for the war aim, you know, and it doesn't matter how many die. So that's the really narrative, and they've said that explicitly many times. Netanyahu has explicitly said that. But then you see situations like this where the IDF is using, and repeatedly over many years, like I said, using Palestinians, tying them to the front of jeeps that are wounded Palestinians, because they know that it'll secure them safe passage through the West Bank, i.e. they know that Hamas will not sacrifice even one Palestinian on the front of an Israeli jeep by attacking the jeep. So which is it?
Right.
I would go with the fact that they're using Palestinians as human shields on the front of their jeeps for decades points to the fact that they, that the reality of the situation is that Hamas is much more humanitarian in that respect, much more careful about not inflicting civilian casualties.
Yeah.
So it's pretty easy to figure out. But,
yeah. Was that story from the West Bank or Gaza?
It's always in the West Bank, yeah.
West Bank.
Yeah.
Where Hamas isn't in charge.
Yeah,
at
of
all.
Course, yeah. There is no Hamas. But there is some kind of, you know, there's local, quote unquote, non Hamas resistance in the West Bank, you know. They come under attack fairly regularly, but they've been terrorizing the West Bank for decades, you know, because it's fun for them.
We're on the topic. I've seen reports of more individual airstrikes, more atrocities in Rafah, South Gaza.
Yeah.
Is there any movement on the Israelis were going to go in to Gaza?
They are in Gaza.
They are, but with a large ground force? No, I'm sorry, into Rafah in the south.
Oh, yeah.
They were
threatening
to.
Well, they're just bombing various different, you know, dropping bombs on various different concentrations of Palestinian refugees. I mean, the whole place is obviously a refugee camp.
Yeah.
Gaza was originally was a refugee camp with 2 million people in it up until October 7th, and since then now it's a refugee camp. It's refugee camps within a refugee camp, right? So to the extent that Gaza was a large refugee camp, but because it was over so many years, people were able to settle into distinct kind of areas, and they're still refugees from their actual homeland, which is in other parts of what is now Israel or the West Bank. But since October 7th, they've massively displaced all those people, and now they're basically refugees from different parts of Gaza in other parts of Gaza. And of course, the United Nations, UNRWA, I think this week they bombed a...
They're still there. The US threatened to defund them, but they're still working.
Yeah.
The people are still eating. They're still getting enough. There's enough aid, or is there starvation yet? I mean, this started like half a year ago.
Yeah.
Israel threatened even then to starve them, but in practice, that's not actually happened, right? Not fully.
Mm-hmm. This was just this week. Or was it? I'm saying 1 hour ago. Anyway, at least 4 people have been killed in an Israeli air attack near an aid center that was the main headquarters of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Gaza Strip. The airstrike on Sunday hit the main gate of the organization's compound in Gaza City in the north of the enclave. So this is basically United Nations, right? I mean, apparently, according to Israel now, the United Nations is no different from Hamas, apparently, according to them.
They made that spiel up when they claimed that they found that several of the employees were Hamas.
Yeah.
That turned out to be fake news, but it justified attacking this agency before now, which spurred the Biden administration or Congress to say, right, that's it, we're defunding, we're removing our tranche of support for this organization.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been grandstanding. I don't know if that actually, if they followed through on that.
And this was the one I was actually thinking of. That one I just showed you was just from today, basically in the last hour or something. But this one is from yesterday. The International Committee of the Red Cross, different organization, says its offices in Gaza have been damaged by shelling, which killed 22 people who had shot shelter around its compound. Heavy caliber projectiles landed within meters of the office and residences of the Red Cross on Friday. On Saturday, the IDF said an initial inquiry found there was no direct attack carried out by the IDF against a Red Cross facility. It said the incident would be quickly examined and the findings presented. Yeah, no one believes you anymore. And then there was one... when was this? Again, around the same time. just in answer to your question of what's actually going on, what the Israelis are doing, there's this one too, Israeli airstrikes on buildings in Gaza City have killed at least 38 people and injured many more, Hamas says. Well, because there's no one else to actually report it anymore, because Israel has basically killed most of the independent reporters or reporting organizations in Gaza. Israeli military said its warplanes had struck a Hamas military infrastructure sites, and it would provide more details later. Yeah, don't hold your breath on that one.
But that's Gaza City, which they already said they cleared.
But people have come back.
Because people have come back, therefore Hamas has gone back, in quotes. So, yeah.
The airstrikes may have been targeting a senior Hamas official. Israeli media reported that the airstrikes may have been targeting one senior Hamas official, but they
killed 42 people.
Killed up 40 people, but sure, whatever. Yeah, so it's just they're just like shooting fish in a barrel at this point, you know. And they're hoping for, you know, like we said, we kind of predicted this. Not that it was hard to predict, but probably, you know, a few months ago at this stage, you know, malnutrition, disease, polluted water, et cetera, et cetera. That's probably still, you know, part of their plan. They're just biding their time, you know, to see if they can kill them by one means or another, yeah.
The UN Secretary General, now he's prone to making dooming comments, but he warned this week that war is coming between Israel and Lebanon. We kind of thought this would happen before now, but it looked like that will be off the cards because of, well, the geopolitical reality of Hezbollah, therefore Lebanon, risking a lot to do that, bringing in the United States and therefore escalation up the chain of escalation. So I'm not sure what his reasoning is. Maybe there has been more activity, exchange of fire. There was one crazy video. Did you see it? The Israelis are using a trebuchet to lob something flaming thing over the wall of the border. I thought it was fake at first, but it was legit.
Yeah, because Lebanon, the Hezbollah had rockets they had fired into northern Israel, had started forest fires, basically. So this was a response. This was a way to try and start fires specifically and directly. It's kind of silly, but this one, again, in terms of what's going on, in terms of food aid, and again, between the Israel and the UN, food weights as Israel and the UN trade blame. Lying in the sun on the Israeli Gaza border, just miles from starving Palestinian families, there are hundreds of pallets of food, from packets of rice to bunches of bananas. Although for the past week, Israel has been observing a daytime pause in fighting on a key stretch of road just beyond the main Karim Shalom crossing point, humanitarian agencies say they are still struggling to get vital aid into southern Gaza. They blame growing lawlessness for making it too dangerous to pick up and move goods.
Right. Yeah, that may be the case.
Check this, but it's
why are people getting lawless?
Well, because they're starving, right? And they come up with, I mean, that's the fundamental nature of it. If you go on down there on a media tour of Karim Shalom, the Israeli military body responsible for operating the crossings, Kogat. That's the Israeli military body, told journalists it placed no limit on the amount of aid that could get into Gaza. We were shown what was said to be a backlog of more than, as the BBC were shown, what was said to be a backlog of more than 1,000 lorry loads of aid, which had undergone security checks and were awaiting collection from the Gaza side. So, security checks, right, there's aid coming in, and who's producing the aid? Well, apparently they don't know, or claim they don't know enough about where the aid's coming from. It's coming from, it's UN aid, it's, what is it, American aid, is it, there's different countries providing aid, but the Israelis are checking them all because there might be bombs or guns or something in there, right? So that's what's delaying it, you know.
Well, it said they have undergone security checks. So in theory, the Israelis have said, good to go. And then this Kogat spokesperson says, the reason they haven't been collected on the Gaza side is largely due to international organizations not taking sufficient steps to improve their distribution capacity. So we don't have enough staff to hand it off the lorries on the other side.
Because they're likely to be bombed or killed or whatever. And this is Koga, this is really a military body. It's not a humanitarian body. The Kogad is an Israeli military body responsible for operating the crossings, right? So they're saying, they're blaming these aid organizations for not distributing it and efficiently enough on the other side, under fire from Israeli bombs.
From Israeli bombs, exactly. Well,
who else?
Yeah, yeah. Well,
who else is bombing Gaza?
That's unsaid here. I mean, there was a notorious incident, was it a month ago, where British and American aid workers, clearly marked as aid, were picked off. Three vehicles in the convoy, droned.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, it was a mistake.
It wasn't a mistake. It was obviously sending a message.
To make there be a scarcity of people to help with distribution on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Israeli army spokesman goes, sorry, yeah, we've checked it, it's fine, but no one wants to pick it up on the other side.
Yeah.
Because we keep killing them.
Yeah. So, yeah, on Hezbollah and Israel and Hezbollah, possible war, yeah, they're talking about it. I mean, people have been expecting it for a long time, but, and people refer to 2006, obviously, which is the last time the Israelis kind of wandered into Lebanon on a kind of badly organized, apparently, and ill-advised invasion with some not very clear objectives, and kind of got their asses handed to them, you know. So people are using that as a reference, but I'd say like since 2006 and since that that particular war, short-lived war, that Israel lost, will have been studied, and you know, they're not likely to make the same mistakes again, you know. So I think what they'll do in the event of a, you know, and who knows who's going to start it, right? I mean, Hezbollah has been given plenty of justification, at least technically, for Israel to launch a war against Lebanon, right? There's plenty of reason for Israel just to say we're going to war with Hezbollah to stop these attacks, you know, stop these missiles and rocket attacks. But so I think Hezbollah will be happy enough to just carry that on, keep that tempo up. So it really, the ball is in Israel's court as to decide to yes or no to go and actually launch a war against Hezbollah or Lebanon. But I think if they do, it'll just be a large scale bombing campaign, and they're just building up their getting their ducks in a row. If they're going to do it, they're getting their ducks in a row, or they're in anticipation of maybe deciding to do it. They're certainly have given themselves the option to do it, which involves amassing large amounts of missiles and bombs from America primarily to just drop on everything and anything in Lebanon. That'll be the Israeli war in Lebanon this time. There won't be many. It'll be similar to, in fact, you could say that they learned from the Hezbollah, the Israel-Lebanon war in 2006. They've learned from that in terms of how they went about dealing with Gaza after they came up with this let it happen on purpose event on October 7th. They, you notice the way they went about it. They just spent about, what, I don't know, a month? Several weeks, anyway. just bombing from the air, bombing Gaza.
Right.
Before they would send in any troops.
Right.
And then send them in so far, and then bomb the next section, and then try and move forward, and then bomb the next section. So just a massive aerial bombing campaign. So I think that'll be the same. It's not a very complicated it's not a very complex military strategy, right?
No, it's
bomb the crap out of it.
It's the Western way of war.
Yeah.
It's what people say, why didn't Putin do that? Because that's that's very particular. It's not the way it's always done. I was wondering, is Netanyahu still in government? I think he still is, right? He still is the prime minister. I've got a story here. He's complaining. This is just published in the Wall Street Journal. This verifies your idea of what they're currently waiting for. But he's complaining about it. Netanyahu complains of dramatic drop in U.S. arms shipments to Israel. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that is what's going on, probably. They're stocking up until they're confident they can just
raise
Lebanon to the ground.
That suggests that
also suggests that
the U.S. is getting cold feet about it. Yeah,
not so fast. Because in the meantime, Hezbollah is publishing like cool like little propaganda videos with drone footage clips of dozens of military sites all over Israel. Like, we've flown over, we know what's there.
This week they published intelligence they gathered about, I think it's in Haifa.
The port there?
Yeah, the whole area, they had identified a bunch of different, you know, high-level or important Israeli military military locations, let's say, or military infrastructure in that area. So, as a warning, there's all sorts of stuff going on behind the scenes, you know what I mean, that they're picking up on, and they know what's going on through back-channel kind of stuff. Or you can get a read on how close, if they've moved a bit closer to, or if one side gets the intimation or has an idea that the other is going to attack them, then they'll put out certain things to try and maybe dissuade them. Like, you better be careful here, you know. Like, Hezbollah releasing this information about their intel that they'd gathered on these very important, you know, not necessarily of any interest or significance to the average person, but would be interesting, I suppose, if they're accurate, would be like, might send a chill down the spine of the Israeli military command. Holy shit, that's not just them making shit up. Those are actually very particular areas. How do they find out about that? And okay, do we want to think twice about, you know, what's going to be the blowback on this, you know, if we were to launch a war against Hezbollah, you know? So Hezbollah puts that out to say, just, we're hearing chatter on the internet, on the interwebs, we're hearing chatter in these back channels that that you may be ramping up towards, you know, launching a war against us. Well, here's what you can expect, you know?
Yeah.
And then that gives them something to think about. So who knows? There's a lot of fury in British media and political circles this week as a result of
election season.
Yeah, fury, and there's not, you don't often hear fury
in Britain. No,
no, but and you know, there's one thing that can provoke fury, you know, amongst a certain group of shitheads.
Shortage of tea.
No, Russia. Yeah, tea. Oh. And this one, furious Nigel Farage blames the West for Ukraine war. It's an incredible moment. Incredible. Hard to believe, really, that the reform leader, Nigel Farage, told the BBC that NATO and the EU provoked Putin's invasion with eastward expansion. He even admits he admires the Russian president. I mean, if that's not reason for fury.
Furious.
Furious.
Do you want to hear what he said? Or?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, furious fury. I feel like getting furious myself. So if I hear him saying it from the horse's
maybe,
mouth.
Yeah, maybe we can relate to Britons who are furious.
Yeah, maybe we'll get a bit furious.
Putin sent his troops across the border in 22. You blame the West, not him. You said, I'll just read it to you and then you can react, that on a tweet, it was a consequence of EU and NATO expansion. Is that a judgment you stand by?
Right.
You stand by that.
You don't know. I stood up in the European Parliament in 2014 and I said, and I quote, there will be a war in Ukraine. Why did I say that? It was obvious to me that the ever eastward expansion of NATO and the European Union was giving this man a reason to his Russian people to say they're coming for us again and to go to war.
But you were echoing him.
I was... Sorry.
You were echoing him.
That's you were echoing him.
No. Sorry, I've been saying this actually since the 1990s. Ever since
so
before the war. But hang on a second. We provoked this war. It's, you know, of course it's his fault. He's used what
but
we've
done. But we provoked the invasion of Ukraine.
Yes, and very interestingly, once again, 10 years ago when I predicted this, by the way, I'm the only person in British politics that predicted what would happen. And of course, everyone said I was a pariah for daring to suggest it. George Robertson, former Labour cabinet minister, who went on to become the Secretary General of NATO, has in the last couple of weeks said the war is a direct result of EU expansion.
But I'm asking,
But I'm asking you, are you Putin himself? I mean, because you're echoing him.
I'm not feeling furious.
And there's a picture of him behind you. What's I mean, are you literally him? I mean, are you literally saying, like, Putin, in March 2022, Putin sent his troops across the border into Ukraine. Now, you blame the EU and NATO. So you're literally saying that the EU and NATO actually has control of the Russian army. And they are the ones who actually sent them across the border. Is that what you're saying? That sounds to me like what you're saying. Because I'm a fucking retard. And I couldn't think my way out of a wet paper bag. So, like, you're literally saying that the EU and NATO is to blame for putting the troops across the border. How could that be possible? The EU and NATO don't actually have control over Russian troops. It's Putin that has control over Russian troops. And Farhad has said, yes, of course it's his fault. Because, no, I'm not saying that the EU and NATO actually sent the troops across, because they don't have control over the Russian military, because that's a different country to the EU and NATO. But...
So what you're saying is
you're
understand. A Kremlin troll.
I don't understand. How could it possibly be someone else's fault that someone would do something? When someone does something, it's totally their fault. I mean... No one ever does anything in response to what someone else does. That doesn't happen. You know, try and help me here, because my brain doesn't really work very well after the COVID vaccination. I can't really think very well or very in very simple linear terms. So explain to me, how is it that the European Union controls Russia's troops?
Well, Joe, it involves Freemasonry.
You're one of those.
This is hilarious, because until then, the British media just ignored Farage. Hmm. Like, there's an election in 2 weeks. And he didn't, it wasn't even, maybe he was on a few, you know, question times and debates on TV, but otherwise it's like, just don't talk about him. But now he got headlines all week long after this. Because they were kind of like, yes, we've caught him. Let's blast this out everywhere. And that will make people not like voting for Farage or Reform.
Yeah.
What happened was his numbers in the polls went up this way. So I think it's hilarious. It's like, okay, don't give him airtime. Oh, wait, yes, give him airtime over this. Mm. This will hurt him. And it had exactly the opposite effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Telegraph and other are running today, following up on that. I think it was yesterday or something. So Farage is victim-blaming Ukrainians for the invasion. So you're saying the Ukrainians are the ones who actually invaded themselves. Is that what you're saying? So you're saying that it wasn't actually the Russians who actually invaded Ukraine. It was Ukraine that invaded Ukraine. And the Ukrainians have been killing Ukrainians. Is that what you're saying? Because I've heard Putin say that. Are you echoing what Putin said? Is Putin inside your head? Are you inside Putin's head? Is there some kind of virus? A Putin virus that has infected you and you need a vaccination?
Somebody said that. Zelensky said that this week. He said that, you know, do you have something on it?
Mm.
He said that the Putin virus has got into Trump.
You think I'm making... You see the way I just said that and you thought, that's really ridiculous, Joe, what you're saying. Don't be so stupid, right? You're saying, like, stop talking about Putin virus. Like, yeah, you're taking it a bit farther. Well, here's the BBC as... well, they're actually quoting... infected with Putin virus. It's actually... Okay, fair enough. It's the Daily Mail. But Zelensky said it. You see the second headline? So I've got some newspaper main pages. Zelensky, Farage is infected with the virus of Putin. The Ukraine leader's fury. So it wasn't fury amongst the British people necessarily. Maybe against some editors of newspapers. Maybe it was fury amongst some editors of newspapers and maybe some politicians who are brain dead, but it was mainly the Ukraine leader's fury after Farage blames the West for war. So yes, it's a Putin virus. It wasn't me who said that.
Such an own goal. They think that this works in their favour. Maybe, I mean, No, I don't think it will. About the thing, can you explain this to me? Farage's Reform Party is polling second or third, depending on who you ask. I finally got into the news because of this quote-unquote fury. But because of the British system, despite winning like over a quarter of the vote, they're only going to get 5 seats.
How does that happen?
It's bizarre.
Democracy, man.
British democracy is weird. This blows my mind. You sent me this earlier, and I thought this can't be seriously what they think is going to happen. It's published in the Telegraph, and they say it was commissioned by them. So this is the right-wing British paper, and they're projecting not just a wipeout of the Tories, but exclusive survey for the Telegraph shows Labour Party on track to win. No, Tory Party on track to win 53 seats.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the number for Labour, 516. That's mad. I mean, for historical context, that's never happened before. There's never been that size of a winning margin ever in the oldest parliamentary liberal democracy on earth. And the question you put to me was, would conservatively minded Britons really vote that high for a Labour option that is basically like Tony Blair's New Labour?
Mm-hmm.
It's new Labour. It's ultra faux Labour. Well, why would they do that? It reminded me of the 90% certainty polls that Hillary was going to win in 2016. They're either going to get one hell of a surprise, or they've learned their lessons and they're going to have to rig this like we've never seen before.
Tony Blair's Labour, it's not Labour at all. Like they kicked Jeremy Corbyn out and eviscerated all the traditional Labour, lefty Labour candidates.
Under an anti-Semitism witch hunt.
Under anti-Semitism. That was the main means by which they did it, which was hilarious but horrible at the same time.
They can't beat Farage with that because...
Because he loves Israel.
He's uber Israel.
Yeah.
So now they found something to beat him with, Ukraine, and they're banking on that being enough to prevent him winning a seat, much less his party doing it all well. He thinks Farage thinks they're going to become the number two party, the formal opposition in the...
We shall see.
Barham is just... Okay, so that's weird enough. Weird polling. Weird stuff afoot. But then there's the actual sitting prime minister. Remember we said before that when he announced a snap election and his program, he said, number one, the first thing would be to reintroduce national service. And like I was thinking, that's the first thing you're telling people? That's not going to go well. He's doubling down. Here he's asked on some BBC Question Time about this for some details about his number one policy. Have a listen.
National service will be compulsory. The military option will be something that people choose to do.
Oh, I see. So how will you make people do it?
Sorry?
If national service is going to be compulsory, how will you make people do it?
Well, you'll have a set of sanctions and incentives, and we will look at the models that are existing around Europe to get the appropriate mix of those. There's a range of different options that exist.
For example?
There's all sorts of things that people do across Europe, whether that's looking at driving licences, other access to finance, all sorts of other things. The right thing to do
access
is to allow...
Access to finance?
Yes.
So if people don't want to do national service, what, you're going to take their bank cards away?
No, there's access... There's lots of different models around Europe. There's lots of different models around Europe. This is being done in multiple countries in Europe.
I don't doubt it. I'm just asking you what you think.
So there's a range of things, and we will have a royal commission look at all of those, come back to the government and recommend what the appropriate mix of incentives and sanctions is.
Have you heard what the motivation is for that? What the rationale is? Why they want to bring back national service?
No.
You haven't read it anywhere?
No. But I just note that France and Germany are talking about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
The United States, we mentioned last week, has passed a law that would basically put everyone age 18 to 26 into a database.
Automatic database, yeah.
If you're not in it, you must. That has a compulsory element to it as well. You must basically register to be in a position to be drafted.
Yeah. Officially in America, you're meant to do that anyway. Everybody's meant to register.
Oh, yeah.
But this is something where they would make it automatic.
Okay.
Where you would automatically be registered in the database, which obviously is, yeah. Because, you know, beforehand it was like, yeah, you should register for it. If you don't, well, nothing's going to happen. But now it's like, well, you'll be on a database and maybe something might happen. So, yeah, it is definitely a step in a more kind of coercive Orwellian direction. But it's strange how they all happened at the same time. Yeah, all came up at the same time. And yet there's no clear explanation as to, from any individual country, why you would want to do this at this time. Except that happens in the background of them talking about having to go to war, you know, mobilizing or conscription for war with Russia. I mean, it happened right on the heels of that. You had talk about that, particularly in the UK and in European countries, about, you know, there's going to be NATO troops, or there's going to, you know, so they're talking about war with Russia, and then they bring in forced conscription, forced national service. Because, of course, that, it could very easily segue from a law that says, you know, you're required, or various coercive measures that require you to do your national service for 1 year. All 18-year-olds, and then a draft from that group of people, right?
Yeah.
So it'd be a way to throw a load of 18-year-olds into the meat grinder. You know,
you saw how Rishi Sunak fumbled that, but despite the fumbling, it's, and maybe he doesn't want it. He doesn't really believe in himself. But, like, it's on the agenda. Okay, I'll talk about it. Basically, the choice for Britons is vote for the Tories or Tory-lite Labour, and we're going to war with Russia,
mm-hmm.
i.e. you boys are going to the fields somewhere, maybe not France this time, but somewhere in the green fields of Europe, or vote for Farage for peace with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
There's a choice. So which one is it? It's A or B. And the polls are saying you're all going to almost overwhelmingly, like 90%, vote for war with Russia.
Mm-hmm.
Something's cooking here. Like, we're being asked about. I think that's what they're trying to corral us into. And it's not ultimately, there's still a question of what is it? Because we've talked over and over about the structural impossibilities of actually fighting a conventional war with Russia, because it just goes straight to the mad situation too quickly. So what else is it? Well, war footing, a wartime, war emergency economy, tighter domestic controls. You can see, we can't see how it happens because we don't know what. It looks like war, an actual war would be the rationale. There'd be an incident and then, oof, we're at war, but it could be something else.
Mm-hmm.
But what you would have, the net result of all this shenanigans would be more centralized control, more clampdown on rights, less freedom. He said it there. Well, you know, we're looking at driver's licenses and access to financing, i.e., if you don't do certain things.
Right. Yeah. I have, at least from Rishi Sunak, I mean, I haven't read it in other places, but I mean, the most you get out of from the government since it was Sunak and his campaign policy, his campaign promise, whatever, this is a good thing, national service. He said, this is a great country, but generations of young people have not had the opportunities or experience they deserve, and there are forces trying to divide our society in this increasingly uncertain world. I have a clear plan to address this and secure our future. I will bring in a new model of national service. to create a shared sense of purpose among our young people and a renewed sense of pride in our country. That's what it's for. That's what it's being flown.
Mm.
The banner's being flown under. Pride in our country, nationalism.
Vague, very vague.
The fact that it's happening at the same time as we've just been incessantly talking about war with Russia is, it's not relevant. It's not connected to that at all. Seriously, believe me.
You mentioned last week about what happened to Liz Truss in connection with France, because Macron himself or someone in France, so who, I can't remember, it was a Telegraph article that someone made the connection that the financial pressure that was brought to bear against Truss, that basically Ussler was being threatened even before a Le Pen government comes to power in France. I think there's a connection here, but I'm not 100% sure. But I can't find it. Okay, never mind. Basically, the European Union this week just incidentally published a report that they're worried about France's public debt. And that it's basically time to cut back on the size of the French budget or something like that. And it wasn't, no reference was made to Le Pen, but it was hard, like the independent objective report from Brussels was that France, Slovakia, Hungary, and maybe Italy need to rein in spending. And anyway.
This is from the Telegraph, 12th of June. Le Pen victory threatens Liz Truss-style debt crisis.
Right. That's crazy. Ahead of time, they're already...
You could rework that, you could reword that like and say... Le Pen is threatened with a Liz Truss-style debt crisis if she tries to win the election.
That's what they're doing. They're threatening, and that's what Brussels did this week. But then, just a by the way report, France's debt. Oof, got to rein that in. Hello, you know, you didn't think that was a problem before now, but we've seen that before. It's so sneaky, and it's supposed to be like just objective financial stuff. It's not politics. It's separate from politics.
It's totally coincidental that it happens right at this time.
It's like the separation of church and state, you know, the separation of monetary control and politics. That's a staple of Western democracy. There's never any connection between what's going on politically and how money should be printed and spent.
How about them sanctions?
Which ones?
Those ones there. After 2 years of drought, Russia overtook the US as the biggest LNG supplier to Europe in May.
Okay, it doesn't come through our pipelines. Well, it comes on our ships.
Yeah, you blow up our pipeline, we give it to you on ships because you need it. Because obviously you need it. What, were you just going to like cut off our cut off the 50% dependency you have on Russian gas and just get it from where? From like... a tree or something? Does it grow on trees? Gas?
So all that happened is it became more expensive. But it still comes from Russia. Because it has to. Mad. The only reason there are 500 million people in Europe is because of Russian energy.
Yeah. And then...
On French politics, I don't really have an update on what's going on, but yeah, it's coming up June 30th. Week today, the first round of voting for French parliamentary election. But the latest poll is Macron's rating has reached a new low. His approval rating is 28%. I think it's a record low. So approval rate, and this is published like in... well, I got it from Politico, but I'm pretty sure it's like put it up there. Maybe we'll see where it says it's from. It's not. It's a what the polls say. That's support for each party on the right. That's Le Pen's at the top. Then the lefty one. Then the yellow is Macron's.
Mm-hmm.
So you would expect the results to be reflected of that. If it's way off from that, something's not right. Scroll down to the next chart. That's the one I have in mind with approval rating. Yeah. France, Macron's approval rating, disapprove at the top. 71%, approved 28%. It's gone up in the last, I think that time scale is like the last week. It had flatlined, but it's gotten worse. So if you see results that have, 50-50 or close to parity or even a miraculous win for Macron's party, remember this, because it doesn't fit with the snapshot just before the election.
Yeah.
Just by the way, that the thing that caused the fury in the UK, like a bit of truth for once from a politician. Trump said it on the same day in an interview with David Sacks. I don't know if that's a big deal. Is it somewhere saying that it's the first time they've actually heard him say that the Ukraine war was caused by NATO expansion? Maybe it's the first time he fully articulated, but it's clear that Trump has, thought something like that for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Same with Farage, to be honest. But it's curious that it was the same day that they both made that statement and kind of went viral.
Yeah. And more about them sanctions. Germany calls for sanctions against Russian nitrogen fertilizers.
I have 1 foot left. Let me shoot it.
According to the data, since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, exports of Russian nitrogen fertilizers to Germany have increased by 920%. In light of these developments, representatives of political forces are calling for immediate measures to restrict imports of Russian fertilizers through sanctions. If in doubt, more sanctions. But the sanctions didn't work last time. In fact, they just did the opposite. Well, do it again. You didn't do it hard enough the first time.
This time next year, we'll be reading a report that of a 9,000% increase in Russian nitrogen imports to Germany. Draft.
National service.
Yeah.
Germany needs 75,000 more troops as NATO eyes Russia threat, according to Spiegel. That's 2 weeks ago. But, I think basically Europe doesn't really have much in the way of a military. A trained military or military that...
Ukraine was Europe's largest.
Yeah.
2 years ago.
It doesn't have much in the way of France, military personnel who have actual... Because it's very, very different. You can build up a military in terms of just recruiting people to the military, put them into barracks, put them through training, blow up some fake bombs and some smoke bombs and stuff and have them run around in a field in middle England somewhere, and then say, okay, now I've got a military. But yeah, you don't really. I mean, the only military that's worth its salt is a military that actually has combat experience, and has... come through that trial to really understand what it's like, so, and I know this, so there's very few of such people, such soldiers in anywhere in Europe, right? So the thing to do is, in the event, and this, I still don't believe that there's going to be a direct conflict between EU, NATO, US, whatever soldiers and Russian soldiers in Ukraine or in Europe or in Portugal or wherever, but these people seem to be talking it up, and I mean, it's getting a bit concerning in the sense where they start a draft or a military service, which would then lead into a conscription and a draft or whatever. But one solution to not having enough troops and combat-ready or combat-experienced troops to fight against Russia in some kind of conventional war is you just get loads of kids, basically conscripts, 18, 19, 20 years old, whatever, who are on doing their military service. And then at that point, you launch invasion, just throw them all as the first line of, you know, a mass human body attack type thing, you know.
A human wave, which they accuse Russia.
Yeah, a human wave of expendable people to use up Russian shells and stuff like that, you know. That's the cynical.
Yeah. Well, that's where the inertia is going there. That's it. It takes on its own. That's how World War One started. It's just mobilization starts, and lo and behold, it's just on the way now. Yeah.
Did you hear? I haven't said much about Trump, but Trump's still trumping along there. He was Turning Point Action, some conservative sort of conference, whatever, just about a week ago or so, less than a week ago. Here he is with the hand movements, the openly closey hand movements on Ukraine.
I think Zelensky is maybe the greatest salesman of any politician that's ever lived. Every time he comes to our country, he walks away with $60 billion. And I like him, you know, on the impeachment hoax number one, he was very good. He said, no, the president didn't threaten me at all. He could have been a grandstander and said, I was threatened, right, Matt? He could have said, I was threatened. So I like him. But he's the greatest salesman of all time. He walks in. So now here's the beauty. He just left 4 days ago with $60 billion, and he gets home and he announces that he needs another $60 billion, else it never ends. It never ends. I will have that settled prior to taking the White House as president-elect. I will have that settled.
Well, Trump supporters certainly want that kind of thing settled and no more money for Ukraine, but is Trump going to be allowed to win? Or is it going to be rigged? Or are they going to off him? I don't know.
I have prediction fatigue. I don't know.
Yeah, speaking of demagoguery, bet you never thought. Maybe you did think, but did you ever think you'd see a demagogue in France that looks like that? I mean, the one on the right, Anyway. So this was revealed by Europe One, which is a news outlet in France during the week, that Macron, according to some sources, it had been discussed in the Elysee, Macron was discussing with his quote-unquote advisors about the possibility of activating Article 16 of the French Constitution, which basically gives him emergency powers. It's like saying, oh, there's a threat to the national security or national, you know, the standard kind of like national security threat, or for some reason public structures, i.e. the government and local governments, whatever. Many different ways you could use it. You know, many different things could happen that you could say, oh, well, that justifies activating this, right? If somebody burns down a few town halls or something like that. So basically, when the public structures are not able to fulfill their function, or if there's some threat to national security, then Macron would be able to activate Article 16 of the Constitution. In which case he would become the supreme Jupiter and arch closet homosexual of France.
I actually wouldn't mind seeing that.
Yeah, he could, if he did it, he should come
and
out.
It wouldn't
in like
last
a,
long, but it would be fun.
He should come out in like a toga.
Our dear leader.
He should come out in a toga.
Yeah,
you know, on the day that he, if he were to
holding the Olympic torch.
Yeah, flanked by two trannies. And he was saying, I am now the supreme ruler of France, along with my handler, Brigitte.
And I really would like to see this.
And you must all bow down and pay homage to me as Jupiter. A very particular spelling.
No, I think they should go for it. Realistically, no, I don't think he has the gumption. I think it might play out well in his head, but when it came to it, it takes a certain kind of balls, and Emmanuel doesn't have them.
No?
No.
What kind of balls?
Big brass balls.
Gay ones?
But can you imagine? He's too effete. He's too... He likes power, but he likes to be loved as well. And when that happens, you're going full President Snow. Like floggings, whippings, executions.
Yeah, but you know...
To back it, to sustain it.
Late Roman Empire. There was a lot of light in the loafer types who ruled as
tyrants.
Very, very dysfunctional tyrants during that time.
Okay, it's possible. But I would imagine it has to happen in the US first, being the center of the empire, you know, the seat. I can't imagine France racing ahead and saying, oh, fuck it, the hell with
democracy.
It's already
happened in America with Big Mike.
Yeah, but Big Mike didn't
rule
with an iron dong fist. You know, it was just the president's partner. But this would be different. This would be definitely crossing Rubicon stuff where, I mean, they're not, he wouldn't literally do it under the guise of I'm dissolving the Fifth Republic, but it's close to it. It's like emergency powers for how long? The article in the Constitution that allows for that says, well, it can last for a couple of months.
Mm.
And then the Constitutional Court in France can review it and so on. But to rule as dictator for even a year, there's been no such... there have been exceptional times, like during the wars, but that's really a Roman era thing. Dictator wasn't the pejorative thing back then. If someone was given the clear mandate for a year or so. But for Macron to break the mold in our time, maybe. Like I say, it would be funny. I think it would obviously be worrying, but you know what French people are like. How long is it going to last before there's... This time the rebellion won't just be yellow vests and large protests.
You know, it would be awesome.
It'll be full-on revolution.
It'd be awesome if he did it. If he invoked Article 16, became the supreme Lord Jupiter of France, and he came out in a toga, flanked by two trannies.
Yeah,
and during that period, obviously, then because if that happened before, like so, July 7th. Is the second election, and if then it all goes down
second round,
and that's when it's definitively the, let's say, the Farc get in, then all the lefties start wrecking France and stuff, then he declares national emergency and Article 16, and I'm the Jupiter ruler, and then a couple of weeks later, that's ongoing now, he's now the supreme ruler of France, and a couple of weeks later, it's the Olympics. And then you have Macron
in a toga,
at the Olympics, giving thumbs up and thumbs down. It's Rome, man. It's a Colosseum.
Yeah.
Literally a Colosseum. He'll be at Colosseums. There won't be any lions or elephants or stuff like that, thankfully. But it'll be, you know, bread and circuses with the supreme ruler waving at the people. And
oh, I hope we're in that timeline. That would be a lot of fun.
History doesn't repeat, but it rhymes, man.
That's definitely next week. The next two shows are definitely going to be about the elections in Britain and France. Until then, really, we've tried to predict stuff before. Certainly I have, and it got it completely wrong. Just before Brexit, I said it's never going to happen. And in a sense, you were right, post-Brexit, it didn't really happen. You got Brexit light, but whatever. I genuinely thought that as much as Brits might like to vote themselves out of the EU, there's no way they'd win the referendum. But they did, which stunned me. I guess the idiots just... Because we were cynical after the Scottish referendum, 2014, when obviously, if anyone knows anything about Scotland, of course they voted to leave the UK, but somehow they just didn't, you know. So anyway, we'll see where that one goes. I want to say something about I wonder if these two issues are linked. Viktor Orban said something kind of conspiratorial this week. The prelude to it is that Brussels fined Hungary €565 million for not taking in migrants. That was on June 13th or so. It's €1 million a day fine. Well, there's a base fine of €200 million and then €1 million per day additional. And it's been a year since they didn't meet some obligation that they had to, apparently according to the rules. Hence the reason it's 200 plus 365. That's a lot of money for Hungary, but it's still, they get around 10 billion a year from Brussels, from the redistribution of the pool of funds that all the member states have. So it's still in their interest to stay in the EU, but that is a hell of a, that's a whack. That's like a 20th of your budget. Just anyway, Orban has since said in an interview in Hungarian, in his native language, while he was visiting somewhere in Germany, that the issue of the war in Ukraine and mass migration are closely linked. What he seemed to be suggesting is that Hungary is being punished, not really because it's not taking in migrants, but because it's against the war.
Mm-hmm.
And he specifically blamed a guy named Manfred Weber. He's some German politician who figures. This is the RT write-up of the interview, so I can't verify that their translation is accurate from Hungarian, but the headline they went with, he said a lot of things in it, but the RT's headline is "White Christians Being Replaced in Europe." And Orban named German politician Manfred Weber as the Beelzebub behind this population replacement. He said a militant faction of pro-immigration politicians is overseeing the replacement of white European Christians with Muslim immigrants. In Europe, there's been an exchange of populations. The number of white Christian traditional, let's say European people, is decreasing. The number of migrants is being imported, specifically Muslims, is radically increasing. And he said that this Weber guy is the Beelzebub responsible for this alleged scheme. Orban continued, adding that European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen is Weber's little servant girl responsible for its implementation. That's quite a thing to say. Now, is he just shooting the shit, or is he divulging that he knows the kind of interpersonal dynamics? He's saying that von der Leyen is just the that's quite a comment, little servant girl for this guy, who leads the centrist European People's Party in the European Parliament. Okay, so he's a kind of a, this guy operates at the European Union Parliament level, but he's really a big player in domestic German politics, such that von der Leyen is his political creature, if you like.
So we're talking about Eminence Grease here.
Yeah. So I looked him up. There's no major red flags beyond the usual. He is totally like a textbook. Let me see. there's a big Wikipedia page on him, but he's just a textbook politician. I didn't see anything that stands out in his past, except that he is Jewish. That's just, you know, by the way.
That's 5 anti-Semitisms out of 5 right there.
Yeah. Sorry, but that's what it says. I didn't get a link. Anyway, look him up on Wikipedia. I can't type this thing on this new keyboard. That's it. It was curious to me that he would say such a detailed thing and also explicitly link the two issues.
Wasn't there a...
That Hungary's being fined on paper for not obeying migration rules or obligations or whatever they are supposedly signed up to, but in reality it's because they're against the war.
Wasn't there a Greek politician several years ago, around 2015, 2016, with the whole when the immigration was really at its peak and an issue, and they were talking about ISIS among the immigrants and all that kind of stuff. I think it was a Turkish politician, was allegedly. I don't know if it was said exactly who it was, but or maybe it was a Turkish politician saying that he had heard people talking about how he had overheard people talking about how immigration was being used as a political tool, basically, or as a weapon against other states. You know what I mean? So I think that's been around for quite a long time.
Directed mass migration.
To give certain countries a problem. You know.
I mean, we know, we're familiar, of course, with the Great Replacement Theory, the Kalergi Plan that goes back decades or even a century. I don't think it's that per se. I think it's more modern than that. But it's a can of worms, because you don't get... Well, Orban has said it before. He has published... There is a clip of him holding up at a news conference a specific document that he says is it something signed by Soros? It involves Soros specifically. And the EU migration pact and how that was drafted and why and stuff. So he's doing it again here. There's another hint of some things he knows or suspects strongly as to an actual plan, as opposed to like a vague, you know, the structural forces. Well, there's just people coming and we have to take some of them in. There's so many, blah, 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 blah.
Well, we'll see. Well, we've already seen.
I wish I could have a clear picture on it. I know there are people out there who take a very definite stance. You know, oh yeah, it's being done to us, and there's all these people, and that's definitely what their plan is. But they sound so certain, but what proofs do they have? It just seems intentional to them. Sometimes you don't know. It looks like it is intentional. Other times it's like, well, who?
Yeah, but haven't we already determined that it's almost official and openly stated government policy in European countries for mass immigration in order to fill out the workforce?
Yeah, the economic rationale. Yeah, but that comes under structural. But that's not an intentional plan to replace Christian traditional Europe. That is for specific political purposes to water down the culture. That's a level of economics. Everyone can agree. Chuck Schumer's recently said that's what it's for in the US.
Yeah.
That's no longer a conspiracy. That's acceptable talk.
Yeah.
But it's when you drill one step downstream from that the intention is to erase or to brown or to amalgamate your traditional culture.
Well, wouldn't that happen anyway?
That would be a product anyway, yeah.
So, yeah.
Putin's visit to North Korea.
Oh yeah,
that was lovey-dovey stuff.
Yeah. You gotta show the video.
Which one? There's so many.
Hmm?
The airplane one.
Yeah,
I have it as well.
Peak level romance.
Yeah, this one. Now there's been some debate as to what exactly Putin was doing here. Some people take the strong view that he was... Do you have it?
Yeah.
That he was making a heart symbol.
No, he wasn't. You go down just like... Bye. See you later. Bye. Like right there is probably up in the air already, and they're still waving.
You know when you leave someone off at the airport,
yeah,
and you're never not quite sure, like, whether it would be rude to leave when they've just entered the security queue, or whether you should wait till they sneak around and you see them one last time, and you keep waving. Well, in North Korea, they just wave you right off into the air for themselves.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think that's a cultural thing going on there. I think that's a North Korean cultural thing where you're meant to stay right and keep waving, you know what I mean? It's okay. Like, they do a lot of waving in North Korea, you know, especially for Kim Jong-il and stuff, you know, and wave for everybody. And, you know, it's like, I think it's a cultural thing. And Putin was obviously would have been
aware
told
of
about
that.
It or done his homework so on it or whatever. So he keeps waving, like, you know what I mean? I mean, in other... When he's visiting other countries, he'll walk up the steps. Like he did in this one and other videos. He walks up the steps, turns around, waves, and then gets on the plane, and that's it. So yeah. He did that, and Kim's down the bottom waving him at the top, and he waves back at him, you know, from the top of the stairs, and stays a bit longer than usual, does a couple of waves, bows, that kind of thing, then goes onto the plane, but then sits down, then deliberately looks out the window and starts waving at him because he knows he's still out there waving. And Kim hasn't stopped waving.
He's a nice dictator. Why can't we have a nice dictator? Yeah. Why do we have to have Macron? I mean, can we not have a nice dictator?
Yeah.
If we're all going to have them, like, he gave him two puppies as well. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Putin's probably got a whole, like, how many dogs has he got at this point? Every time he goes to Central Asia, or now North Korea, he picks up puppies.
Yeah.
They got to feed horses together. Kim's horses, his white horses. Have you seen him riding those things? They're huge.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, he's short, but still, they're huge horses.
Yeah. What's, I just saw you post something there, repost something from Nick Fuentes. 8 seconds of Ben Shapiro. What was that? Do you remember?
Well,
that was 21st of June. That's 2 days ago.
I think it was him... Ben Shapiro, something about Ben Shapiro, and it was like a very tiny clip from his plea for Americans to support Israel, because he knows the overhead window shifted. He knows that we're losing this year, so he's frantically trying to win them back.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what it was said, but Fuentes just laughing at it.
Yeah. Yeah, Kim Jong-un give Putin two dogs, Akita breed.
And Putin gave him the Aurus, and they were driving the Aurus limo around.
Yeah.
It was all very cute and lovey-dovey. But what was this really about, though? For here's the thing. Putin's last visit was in 2000. He hasn't been there since. This almost completes a story arc, this 24 years. It's his first year in power. He goes to North Korea. I think it was his first foreign visit as Russian president. And obviously he met his father then. And then that's it. But what happens in the interim is, in general, the broad sweeps of history, Putin goes, we're going to be looking west. You know, I have a westward outlook. Russia's going to integrate with the West one way or another. He's literally just offered Clinton that Russia join NATO.
Mm-hmm.
He's serious about comprehensive settlement to the Cold War.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't happen. Instead, the U.S. goes, excellent. The USSR is off our back. Let's go apeshit in the Middle East.
Mm.
And then that's the first resistance. Putin with Chirac on one side and Schroeder on the other says no to the Iraq war, pissing off London and Washington, because they go, well, shit, we wanted a UN mandate for that. Well, fuck it, we're going in anyway with the Coalition of the Willing, which already watered, right there 2 years later, the political capital the US accrued after 9/11 was already diluted by Putin, and they never forgave him for that. That was the beginning of their unforgivingness with Putin. Of course, it took a lot more slings and arrows. And then 2007 comes along, the Munich, that's infamous speech in Munich Security Conference from Putin. But all this time, North Korea, for Putin's outlook, is like the past. It's the communist past we're getting away from. It's mm-hmm. We don't want to be isolated like them. We want to be in the world community. We want to be in them.
Yeah, but
and it's a funny story arc that they come around being isolated anew. Not through any choice, ideological communist choice of their own. And then who's with them in the trenches, literally saying, you can have as much as you want. Here's all the ammo you need for Ukraine war.
Mm.
It's North Korea.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hell of a story. Because who in the end was your friend? You know, who was reliable?
Well, I mean, it was obviously a non-starter. Like, the Russians offering to join NATO was like, nah, dude.
No, I know. But
that was obviously non-starter. And they didn't know it at the time, but obviously that was non-starter. Like, America owns NATO. America owns, through NATO, America owns the world.
I know,
and you have Russia come along saying, hey, I'll join NATO. And America's like, no, because, like, you're pretty big there. And if you were to, like, if you were to realize your potential and stuff, you would be, like, a competitor to me. You would basically want a seat at the top table with me, and we would have to split the world together. And America's like, nah, well, I'm not splitting the world with anybody. Like, I mean, you do what I say, or we're going to tear you apart.
It's a bad example, but the intention was behind it was a new security arrangement in Europe. Because what was happening in the 90s, and again in the 2000s, was waves of NATO expansion. And Putin was like, can we stop this shit, please? And then right before Bush leaves after his second term, Bucharest conference, where the first dreaded words were issued, we're considering that Ukraine joins NATO. Maybe he was trolling, maybe he wants to, maybe he wants to get a reaction, you know. Whatever. My point is that he was trying to orient Russia to genuinely integrate with the global economy, right?
Mm.
Okay, it's Western dominated. But he would have certain terms that would have to be respected along the way. And he just got ignored, or they were just rolled over at every turn.
Mm-hmm.
And you come full circle, and he's now basically at war with the West.
Mm-hmm.
And North Korea is still, hello, waving in the background, we've always been with you.
Mm.
Okay, so what? It's a small country, right? 23 million people. It's not that big a deal. But it might well be. This might be the beginning of Putin's asymmetrical response to the U.S. giving Ukraine long-range weapons to fire into Russia. Because what they have agreed is a comprehensive, basically, not just a
military cooperation,
and defense cooperation. And security, yeah. If you're attacked, we defend you, and vice versa.
Yeah, and America's got a giant base in South Korea, in Seoul. And also, you have this angle, so it's not... And then afterwards, he goes to Vietnam cozies up with the Vietnamese. So, yeah, it's like certainly present in Asia.
The two countries that were... Major wars in the 20th century.
But this one, if you click on the picture there, Scotty, Russia threat, this is 2 months ago, roughly, Russia threatened South Korea against providing weapons to Ukraine.
No, it's 2023,
that's last year, but it's been on the burner since then. So what it suggests is that South Korea is making moves to actually... Now, hang on. Well, I'll explain in a second, but it could suggest that either South Korea has already started making moves behind the scenes that Russia got wind of, that they're going to supply weapons to Ukraine, and then Putin decides to go and visit North Korea and sign a military pact type thing and say, listen here, maybe you guys down the south want to think again about giving us problems in Ukraine, because we can give you problems in on your border. But then the South Koreans, in response to this pact that...
Mm.
The South Koreans have said that they are going to reconsider sending weapons to Ukraine.
Nice.
Although they've already done that. I mean, it's such bullshit. Like, South Korea's constitution has part of its constitution or part of its laws are basically that it cannot provide weapons to any country during conflict. It can sell weapons or whatever, and any weapons it produces, but not...
That's Chinese influence.
Not during a conflict.
Yeah.
So the way they got around that was they sent it to America. because America's not at war, right? So they sent a load of shells because America was looking for a lot of for shells for Ukraine, like 155 millimeter shells for Ukraine. And South Korea had a lot of them, so South Korea said, technically we can't send them to Ukraine. Okay, just send them to us and we'll send them on over. Okay,
yeah, because the American regime has no moral qualms about doing that, of course.
No, and it's not at war, of course. That's why South Korea can send them to the US, because it's not party to the conflict, right? funny people. They're very funny people. They're not serious people, but they're funny. Yeah.
But it's also a signal that if anything kicked off in East Asia, North Korea wouldn't be just left to it. I think if something had happened like 10, 15 years ago, North Korea could have been serious trouble.
Mm-hmm.
There is a history, of course, of China defending it in the Korean War. But I think that also makes me think that Putin didn't go there just as the representative of Russia.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably arranged with Beijing as well.
Mm-hmm.
there's any other big topics we want to cover? Them Houthis are giving the U.S. Navy a run for its money. It's amazing. We have so little to go on because it's kind of a dome of silence placed over by the Pentagon, but the Houthis are still there and they're gloating a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's just bravado.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever about hitting the Eisenhower, it did turn around.
Yeah,
after the Houthis claimed they successfully hit it.
You never know.
The Houthis did, this is accepted and acknowledged in the media, they did hit another cargo ship last week. And unrelated news, but unrelated because the media just doesn't make any bloody connection. But it is, of course, related. We're talking about mass migration. Al Jazeera, this is from last week. At least 49 dead, 140 missing in migrant boat sinking off Yemen. Refugees and migrants are increasingly taking the dangerous route despite instability in Yemen and the fallout of the war in Gaza. Now that, if we can just scroll down, I think it was just a storm. They're not suggesting the Houthis sank this migrant ship.
Mm-hmm.
The vessel capsized, a bit of a... Yeah, so there's no suggestion that it was shot at. It probably was bad weather. Okay, so where are these people coming from? They're coming from Ethiopia and Somalia. This is not Yemeni people fleeing. Okay, so why are Somalians fleeing northwards to Europe? Risking going through, you know, the Yemeni blockade, which they probably don't feel under threat from, because the Houthis are not targeting refugee ships. Why are they leaving Somalia in droves? Jacobin's article here. This is actually an extensive overview of the last three decades. The headline says it all, though. The U.S. helped destroy modern Somalia. You've got refugees pouring to Europe because of American wars. That's not the only reason, of course. They are also incentivized to come. There is enough evidence on the ground that that's happening as well. But that right there is the answer. Why are Somalians turning up in Europe? It's one thing for Syria is closer to Europe. You can understand that. Somalia, they have to go through like the blockade in the Red Sea, the war in Gaza, and then across all of Europe by land. I mean, I have a mainstream report. This is probably a rarity. I don't know how often the Americans see this. Do we have time to play this? It's a US news report about the effect the Houthis are having on the US Navy. 3 minutes. Let's start it anyway.
Hey there, Leland, and the message from the United States Navy is clear. The whole world is underestimating these Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen. They say that they are capable, they are well-armed, and what is currently happening in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden is unprecedented and unlike anything they've seen before.
Captain, from Yemen where? Okay. Right to the same ship. Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Completely innocent ship that was just hit by the Houthis today. This is every day.
How legitimate are their capabilities?
Yeah, I think people undersell the Houthis' capability. This anti-ship ballistic missile is a game changer.
They're a legitimate terrorist organization, and they conduct attacks almost daily out here.
8 months ago, the average American would have had a difficult time telling you exactly who the Houthis in Yemen are.
They still do.
Since late last year, the Houthis have captured a ship, they have sunk a ship, they've also killed three sailors here in this region.
They've got a lot of advanced weaponry that they've purchased or been delivered from their friends in Iran, and they have no problem using it.
I think our objective is to save lives, to put it very simply.
No aircraft carrier has been busier in the last 5 years than the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower. Over 550 days of deployment within that span. This ship was deployed once again in October. It first arrived in the Red Sea in November.
This word keeps coming up. This is unprecedented. The Houthis have decided to attack maritime shipping.
Over 10% of trade goes through the Red Sea itself, about 30% of the globe's container traffic.
They've also decided to attack U.S. warships as well.
We're the first ship targeted by an anti-ship ballistic missile. We're the first ship to shoot down an anti-ship ballistic missile in combat in history.
So we just saw what's behind this door, which is the Combat Information Center. From the second that one of those missiles is fired at this ship, there's a lot of decisions that need to be made. How to intercept, where to intercept, what kind of tools to be used. All of those decisions, in some cases, have to be made in a matter of seconds.
We've got some exquisite capabilities, both defensive and self-defense.
Naval aviators have played such a key role in the United States' efforts against the Houthis in Yemen, being able to go on offense.
When you're sitting in that cockpit and you know that there are very legitimate adversaries that are on the ground, what goes through your mind?
I'd try to pretty much just think about the mission itself.
Good math.
I don't think outside the box.
At like 2 a.m., going in there knowing that we were the tip of the spear in the case.
I follow orders. I'm the tip of the spear.
5,000 souls aboard here. What keeps you up at night?
I'll tell you this.
Caffeine.
I keep the Houthis up at night.
Oh, you do? I keep the Houthis up at night.
Now, obviously, that's a propaganda puff piece, but I think it still comes through there that the Houthis, they're taking them seriously.
To the danger zone.
It's eternally Top Gun in some people's heads.
Well, in the American Navy, they still live in the 1980s. And it was interesting to say that that's the thing, the salient point there out of all of that, and, you know, is that they said the Eisenhower aircraft carrier, whatever its group, whatever was the first, that was whatever ship he was on, and that group was the first ship in history to ever shoot down a ballistic missile. I.e., this has never happened before. There is no history in modern warfare, like i.e. post
World War II.
Well, you can probably include post really 20th century. I mean, you could go post Vietnam, but when there's been, you know, more advanced, much more advanced and faster and better missiles,
yeah,
and anti-ship missiles, basically, there is no incident where any have ever been targeted with any of these missiles, and therefore had to shoot them down. This was the first one. And talking about a ballistic missile there, that's just shoot it up and let it fall down type thing. But that doesn't say anything about an actual, you know, a powered, like a non-ballistic missile, as in
cruise missile.
A cruise missile, or some version of cruise missile,
or glide,
or one of the what do they call them? One of the Iranian super missiles.
That
Russia has as well. What's the term?
Hypersonic.
There you go. So, hypersonic missile, which is basically a cruise missile that flies very fast, and you know, evasive maneuvers and all that kind of stuff, and flying very low and changing direction, all that kind of stuff. They've never had to. So the fact they've shot down a ballistic missile, the fact that that's the first time that's ever happened in history tells you that this is all something that they have no experience of.
They don't know,
but if anything they have will actually work. And also the fact that they only ever had to shoot, so far they've only had to shoot down, in this new era, they've only had to shoot down a ballistic missile, which is, okay, it's difficult because of the ballistic trajectory, but you have a much better chance, I think, of defending against a ballistic missile, albeit, they were difficult to do. You have a much better chance to defend against that than against an actual, like a cruise missile or an anti-ship, a more modern anti-ship missile that would be flying a lot faster and would be able to, engage in different maneuverability to avoid being shot down. So if the Houthis get a hold of one of those from Iran, and then, I hope they do. Sink an aircraft carrier. That'll be fun. I'd love to see a CNN report on here we are in the sinking... In the sinking USS Eisenhower.
And your man there would be wearing a wetsuit.
Yeah.
On the life raft.
On a life jacket, yeah. We're on the life jacket. We're on the life raft here, just showing the last signs of the USS Eisenhower as it sinks below the waves. It seems we may have underestimated those Houthis, et cetera, et cetera.
Send help.
Send help, please. Anyway, we better wrap up. And hit the road. Yeah, we hope. I think that's all. You don't have anything else. No, nothing major. There was a. Panic-stricken man ran into the doctor's office.
Ran
into the doctor's office. Says, "You have to help me. I think I'm shrinking." Now settle down, the doctor calmly told him. "You just have to learn to be a little patient." Put him. That was awesome.
It's a good one.
That was the best one ever. Anyway, so we're going to leave
another. That's another Joe one.
That's actually happened to me. Yeah, yeah. I was there. It was actually a doctor told me that.
Yeah. And it struck you that he just said a pun. Was he aware that he just said
a pun? No, just straight face, yeah.
And you logged it in here and said, "I'm going to use that on the show when I get home."
Exactly. That's how it happened.
We need to put these in a book or something. We can sell them. Newsreels.
Best of.
Joe's puns.
Horrible jokes. So we're going to leave it there for this week, folks. Thanks for watching, listening, and commenting. Don't forget to subscribe or hit all the buttons and stuff. We'll be back next week with another show. So until then, have a good week. See you later.
Thanks for watching. Bye all.
Can't stop the signal now.